This is the operator. At this time, I need to remind all parties today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections to this recording, now would be the time to disconnect. And ma'am, now you can begin your call.
Okay, thank you. So, hi everybody. Welcome to the fourth anniversary Charm Telecon. This is part two. Last week we had the first part, and now we are on the second part. There's so much information to cover that we have to break it up. And today we're going to be hearing about magnetospheric science and about Titan science. And so we have with us Dr. Claudia Alexander, who is the Cassini Project staff scientist and is a well-known magnetospheric scientist, and she's been involved in the Galileo mission, and also she is the project scientist on the Rosetta mission. So we're pleased to have her with us today. And we also have Dr. Elizabeth Turtle, who we're also very pleased to have with us. We actually are lucky enough to have her 2 months in a row because she was great enough to do both the Icy Satellites last month and Titan this month. She's at the Applied Physics Lab in Maryland and is a team associate on the Cassini imaging team. So welcome to both of you. Thanks for speaking with us today, and thanks to everybody for joining us. And I'm Amanda Hendricks from JPL, hosting it here. And I think that we're going to start with Claudia talking about magnetospheric results from the Cassini mission so far. So, Claudia, why don't you take it away?
All righty then. So where we are right now is, physically, I'm in London, just so you know. If you can imagine us sitting here in the late afternoon, there's no spot of tea handy, but we'll be having that later. And where we are, metaphorically speaking, in terms of with the Cassini mission, is we have just concluded the prime mission and getting ready for the extended go-off and go for another 2 years on the extended mission. And so it's a time to reflect on, you know, what have we learned, how far did we get in our objectives, and what do we have still to go. So I'm going to actually walk you through what was presented to the project by the Magnetospheric Working Group in terms of what we started out thinking that we were going to learn and then what we actually have learned. And so there's some buzzwords and some things that I may or may not have time to actually address as we walk through this. And so what I've done is I have a little appendix at the back with some pictures that show a little bit about the different regions of the magnetosphere, just for your reference. And I hopefully will have put those, moved them into the body of the talk so I can address certain things. But I'll stop periodically to ask for questions, and certainly if there's a buzzword that I use that you find to be unfamiliar, don't be shy about asking me what it means. So, the very first thing that we wanted to learn about Saturn's magnetospheric environment was about the magnetosphere itself. This is a region of space that's pretty much invisible to the naked eye, and what we need to do is to use our tactile senses to really understand what it is. So things that, instruments that sort of feel and that detect electric and magnetic fields. These are things that we can't see, and so we're using the data to try to reconstruct in our minds what this magnetospheric region looks like. And we fully expected that it would look different from other planets. But the question is was it more Earth-like? Is it more like Jupiter? Since it's a giant planet, you might expect that Saturn's magnetospheric behavior might be more like Jupiter. But Jupiter is a pretty unique planet in the solar system. It's got this enormous magnetic field, very powerful, enormously large structure in space that the whole sun would fit inside. And Saturn's magnetosphere is, we didn't know. So we said the most important thing is to sort of discover what the magnetosphere kind of looks like, but not looking, but feeling our way around. So that means measuring the magnetic field, which is a vector, so you have to measure all three of its positions, angles, and then we expect those to change with time, because a magnetosphere is kind of like a water balloon, so it's kind of always changing and so forth, and so we're kind of not only measuring the magnetic field, but how it floats around in time. And then we needed to measure the charged particles, and when you're measuring charged particles, you're looking at the energy that they have and what they're composed of, and sort of how they're spiraling. They have a tendency to spiral around in the magnetic field, and so we're looking at what is their angular distribution at any given time. And then we also measure the plasma waves in the environment. That tells us a lot about the motions of plasma back and forth in the different regions of the magnetosphere. So after 4 years of going around in the magnetosphere, what did we learn? Well, we learned, I'm going to sort of go out of order according to the list here on page 3. I'm going to say that, first of all, we learned that there's a brand new radiation belt, and it's maybe technically not a radiation belt, but there's a brand new region inside of the D-ring that is related to the magnetosphere. So when we put together all the different regions of the magnetosphere, we're going to include a new one. We learned that, I mentioned in my introduction that we weren't sure whether Jupiter was, whether Saturn was more like Jupiter or more like the Earth. And one of the things that tells us about that is solar wind control, whether the magnetosphere is responsive to the sun or not. And we learned that, in fact, solar wind has very little effect on the Saturn's magnetosphere, which makes it more like Jupiter. So let me go to page 4 and just talk about this a little bit. So on page 4, I have sort of a rigid, you know, back when you were in school, you had a dipole magnet, and you did the little iron filings, and it made the little dipolar shape. And so when you think of a planet with a magnetosphere, you have a tendency first to think, well, you know, if you had those iron filings, they'd make that sort of dipolar shape. And then we sort of mapped out the shape of the global magnetosphere, and it's much more. I mean, it's not dipolar in shape by any stretch of the imagination. So let's go on to page 5. So not only do we have this sort of spider web like field lines stretching both on the day side and on the night side of Saturn's magnetosphere, but we have the penetration of the solar wind, which on page 5 is illustrated with the little orange lines that sort of are perfectly parallel before they get to the bow shock. And then as soon as they enter the bow shock, which is sort of the influence of the magnetic region of Saturn, they're deflected and they start to go around. And so at Earth, the interaction of the solar wind and the plasma that is deflected around that ends up getting into the magnetosphere, there's a very powerful there's a circulation pattern that is driven by the sun on Earth. And when we look at this figure 5, we were trying to figure out whether the sun would have as much influence at Saturn. And the truth is that it does not. On figure 6, I have in the middle magnetosphere these two orange blobs, and basically this is where the plasma resides once it sort of once plasma comes in from the solar wind, and also plasma coming off of the rings and moons resides in this sort of middle area in the plasma sheet. And so we spent a lot of time measuring the energies and directions of motion of plasma going around in that region. I'm going to skip slide 7. I'm not sure why I put the magnetotail in there, but we will get to the magnetotail a little bit later in this presentation. So just keep that in mind, that on this diagram, the sun is to the left, and the magnetotail stretches out in the anti-sunward direction.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Back to slide 6, where you show the orange regions where all the plasma is.
Yes.
Am I looking at that right, that that's in Z? It's in, like, the vertical direction with respect to the equator, that things sort of start moving out after some distance out?
So we're basically looking in the along the equatorial plane, and the poles are perpendicular, so the poles would be headed towards the, you know, the slide header and down to the bottom part. And so
spreads out in the vertical direction?
It does. Right, right. In a sort of a disc form. Okay.
Right.
There's the current sheet, and then and then it expands into a. It fills up the whole space.
Are you going to talk more about that?
I was not, but as we go along, I will think of more to say.
Okay.
We'll look at the Mimi pictures, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Okay. So let's go on to slide 7. I'm on mine. I'm not seeing the number, but slide 7 is this lovely schematic, okay, which is kind of the picture that we put together after feeling our way around for 4 years. And now it's rotated the other way, so the sun is to the right, and the solar wind is flowing along and impinging on the bow shock and the nose of the magnetosphere. And what we see is that it's tilted. Okay, so we learned one of the most important things we learned about the magnetosphere of Saturn is that it's got an obliquity with respect to the solar ecliptic plane that plays an important role in some of the signals that it's capable of making and where the plasma goes. So this sort of tilted look that is depicted here is an important consequence, one of the things that we learned and gained out of the Cassini mission. Let's see, I'm going to make a note here that on the left of this diagram is what we call an X line, and you'll see that there's this sort of dolphin, sort of bottlenose dolphin shape that's about, I don't know, an inch before the end of the page. And then it pinches off, and then there's a little bit more red stuff to the lefter is not a word, of course, but more lefters to the left of the diagram. So you can draw a little X where that pinch is, and the X is an important thing that we still want to look at because one of the things that we know when the sun is driving a magnetosphere, we have reconnection, what they call reconnection in the tail, in the magnetotail. And you have plasma sinks down, pinches things off, and then that more or less region would go shooting off down the tail under certain circumstances, and that would be called a plasmoid. And that's a way that plasma leaves the magnetosphere. And so we're still searching around for evidence of what they call the process of reconnection, which would be an important clue whether the sun is really playing an important role at Saturn or not. So we're still looking at that. So let me go back to page 3 quickly to remind myself what I was supposed to be talking about. Okay, so imaging of rotating and dynamic ring current is one of the findings that we got. And what I want to do is talk about what is a ring current at Earth and what the actual images showed us and what is still to go. So we have on page, whatever page this is, probably page 8, this is the Earth. And what I want to show on the right is what's called the plasmasphere. Okay, at Earth we don't have these big disks, but we do have a sort of balloon-shaped plasmasphere where plasma from the Earth and from the magnetosphere gets trapped very close to the Earth, right, sort of right next to the Earth's atmosphere. If you keep going up into space, you're going to be into the plasmasphere. And on the bottom left is an image of the plasmasphere taken from spacecraft near the Earth, and I sort of drew a picture to the shadow of Earth's shadow, and then off to the left is where these particles are located in the plasmasphere. So if you go to the next page, which is, it says, from the image spacecraft, plasma injection at the Earth. So what happens, I talked to you just a couple pages ago about how we have this X point, and that plasma goes shooting off down the magnetotail, and then what also happens is that plasma comes shooting towards the planet. And this is in a solar-driven magnetosphere. And so on Earth, that process, we have what's called the ring current, And in this diagram on panel one, we have the normal plasma sphere. We have the Earth in the middle there. The sun is to the right, and the shadow of the Earth you can see. And then the plasma sphere is the green stuff. And then the ring current, as plasma comes in from the tail, you have the brightening of the ring current, which is in blue. And then gradually that plasma is ingested into the plasma sphere, and what ends up happening is that you generate aurora. That's the sort of final process of taking all this plasma in. And the next page, page 11, shows the same kind of thing being observed by MIMI, which is one of the instruments of the Cassini magnetospheric suite of instruments that is in Saturn's magnetosphere imaging this plasma injection, ring current brightening as plasma is brought forward from the tail. And so this is evidence of not only solar control, but also the process eventually of how plasma is moving around the magnetosphere from one region to the other, the plasma dynamics through the magnetosphere. And I'm going to skip this next slide because one of the things we also noticed, a very important thing, so I guess I'm not going to skip it, I guess I'm going to talk about it, is that with the obliquity of the magnetosphere, the tilt relative to the solar ecliptic plane, as Saturn spins around, it will beat. And so we're starting to notice a time-varying beating going on in different data sets with different instruments. They're all noticing the same beating. And so one of the big questions that has come out of Saturn, after 4 years of studying Saturn, is we still can't exactly convince ourselves of what the daily rotation rate of Saturn is. And that's a big surprise. I think of it like some of the fundamental things that you learn about the Earth, or like back 100 years ago when they were trying to figure out the longitude and latitude, some of these really important fundamental things you know about the planet. Well, at least you know what the length of the day is. And with Saturn, we are having a hard time pinning it down because the rotation rate seems to be different from what was measured with Voyager spacecraft, and it's even been different. It's migrated in the past 4 years. And so there's a lot of work that's gone into and continues to go into trying to understand what makes these different measurements so different. And that's all I'm going to say about that. I'm going to go on to page 13, and one of the things that we wanted to characterize before Cassini's mission started was what they call Saturn's kilometric radiation. So I'm going to, in the next few pages, talk a little bit about what is kilometric radiation and the effect that what we know about the kilometric radiation, what that has on this question of what is the length of the day. So, I really want to skip page 14, and we'll come back to page 14. I'm going to go on to page 15. What is kilometric radiation? Well, Saturn's kilometric radiation is what we think of as the analog of terrestrial auroral kilometric radiation. And I got a couple of definitions of auroral kilometric radiation. One is from Wikipedia, and one is from Scientific American. Auroral kilometric radiation is the intense radio emission in the acceleration zone many times past the times the distance of the radius of the Earth for where the aurora is. And basically what happens is that as electrons are spiraling down the magnetic field lines and creating the aurora, they generate waves which, when translated into the audio region for the human ear, actually sound like whistles and chirps and other odd noises. So you can actually play an audio tape of the chatter coming from the auroral zone, and that is called auroral kilometric radiation. And in Scientific American, they called it Earth's auroral radio chatter. So So it's associated with the aurora. It's associated with the movement of particles raining down field lines into the atmosphere. And Saturn has a similar kind of kilometric radiation. And one of the outstanding questions is still, how much of an analog is this for the Earth's auroral radio chatter? But that's basically what it is. And now I want to go back to page 14. No, I don't want to go back to page 14. Not yet. Let's go on to page 16. I guess I have a thought missing or a page missing, which is that why would the SKR be related to the beating of the... Why is that related to the rotation rate of Saturn? And what I'm going to say is, because it's still, these are still some of the outstanding questions, it's trying to understand the relationship between the SKR and the beating, but it is beating in a regular fashion that's very close to the spin rate of Saturn, very close, but it's off just a little bit. And now, if we go to page 14, these are all the different measurements, different kinds of measurements that, and you'll see that the differences are, along the bottom is the rotation period of Saturn, and the green line, for example, is the Saturn SKR period, which is almost 10 hours and 45 minutes. And you'll see that that's slightly different from the Voyager SKR period, which was a little bit more than 10 hours and 45 minutes. And we have tracking of clouds, which is this Anderson and Schubert 2007 measurement, which is somewhere around 10 hours and a little bit more than 30 minutes. And I misspoke on the Voyager one, being a little bit less than 10 hours and 45 minutes. So you can see all the data shown here on slide 14 is different. You know, different measurements that have been made of this, and you can see that it migrates around, but it's about 10 hours and 30 minutes, something like that. And trying to pin down which of these measurements is giving us the right rotation period is one of the big questions that is outstanding from the Prime mission. So page 17 is another slide that shows the modulating of certain measurements with that same beating period. And likewise, page 18 is a little bit more about the radio measurements that are going around with periods that are somewhat different from Voyager 1 and 2. So on page 19, one of the primary objectives of math science was to understand Titan, to investigate the upper atmosphere and ionosphere of Titan, and to investigate Titan's magnetospheric interaction. And I'm actually going to stop here for a few seconds and just inquire whether there was any questions on the material that I just covered. Yes, we have a question.
Okay, I think I have a question about the new radiation belt inside the D-ring.
Yes.
Go over that?
Not yet. I'll be honest, I'm not going to cover every single bullet in the talk. Okay, so the new radiation belt, I'm just going to mention that it has also been called basically a ring current. So it's not, it's got some hot particles, but it's not quite a radiation belt. So, but all I'll say is that it's a new region, that when we talk about the regions of the magnetosphere of Saturn, we've got a new one to add to the lexicon.
So is it a new region or a region that is new to us because Cassini flew closer than...
That's correct. That's right. Basically, we had no idea there was radiation inside the D-ring. And so we flew closer in and, whoop, there it is.
So I?
Yes.
Okay. And my other question, was back to slide 4 about... Or no, I guess it was... Where was it? Where I asked before about the plasma sheet.
Yes.
So the reason it's kind of like a nozzle shape, I guess, a little bit, or maybe
that's
sudden where it...
That's misleading, and it's not quite sudden. I mean, the drawing shows this sort of a line and then a nice little edge, and then it starts to grow out. And that's just the artistic rendering.
Okay.
That it doesn't really look like that. And let me see if I included a page that shows what it does look like.
And what I'm wondering is, does it sort of narrow down like that because of the neutrals in that inner part of the magnetosphere? That there just simply isn't as much plasma because it's sort of eaten up by the neutrals?
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
Well, the inner magnetosphere is dominated by neutrals. That's another big finding, and I hope that I have that somewhere later. You have to know that we're required to turn these packages in weeks before. So I turned it in, and then I don't remember what I included in it. So if we can come back to that in a minute, because let me come back to that when we talk a little bit about the middle magnetosphere.
Okay. And I had one more question, but I don't want to dominate in case anybody else had something for right now. Okay, well, my other question was about the reconnection, because when you
talk
about the images of Earth,
right?
And you said that then the sort of end step is the aurora,
right?
Is that the same with Saturn? And is there then an auroral response to solar winds that we can maybe measure variations in? Or that do you know if anybody has
what I heard today? This very week, yesterday it was, the presentation that Bill gave, and just to remind you guys, we are here at a symposium that is discussing Saturn at the end of the Prime mission and what did we learn. And there's some controversy still about what is the aurora showing, because it has, okay, this is a little bit of a sidestep, but I think it's a good point and fun to talk about. Earth's aurora is episodic. Okay, so you see it when there's certain weather conditions of the sun. When the sun and the earth get connected, then the end result of that is aurora precipitating down, and then it gets cut off, and you don't see it anymore. At Jupiter, the aurora is a permanent feature.
And at Saturn, too?
And at Saturn, too. Okay, so that would suggest that it's all has to do with plasma internal to Saturn and not coming from the sun, and it has to do with the moons going around in Saturn. But there are smaller features of Saturn's aurora that have the episodic nature, that have the substorm-like response that happen after these substorms seem to be happening. And so they're still looking for the measurements. When there's a substorm and one of these plasmoids goes off down the tail, then Saturn's magnetosphere does a thing that's called technically dipolarization. So you have these stretched out field lines that look banana shaped or like a dolphin's nose, and then in a dipolarization event, they suddenly they snap to a dipolar. Remember I talked about the iron filings and how you have that dipolar shape like an orange or a, you know. And when it dipolarizes, it has a tendency to push the plasma down the field lines into the aurora. So not only are they seeing these signatures in the auroral zone where they see these episodic brightenings, but they've measured three separate events, dipolarization events, that they are pretty sure are dipolarization events in the 4 years of going around Saturn. So they do think that the sun is exerting an influence at Saturn, but they don't really have enough. The evidence isn't conclusive yet.
Okay, interesting. Thank you.
Okay. Where was I before? I was so rudely interrupted. Okay.
Are we on 19?
We're on page 19. Thank you for reminding me. Okay. So we were going to go to Titan now and talk about the two sort of really, really interesting results. One is that negative ions, I'm just going to read it from page 19, heavy negative ions were detected in the ionosphere of Titan. And this is really strange. And I have to admit, when I first heard about this result, I thought, what are they talking about? What is a negative ion? I did not know, and so I've, on page 20, put a definition of a negative ion, because I always thought that you had an atom, you have electrons, and if you strip off an electron, which is the negatively charged particle, then what remains of any atom is an ion. It's a positively charged thing because the electrons are missing, and that's what it is. So what's a negative ion? I don't get it. So what they are talking about in the ionosphere of Titan is very, very, very heavy particles. So greater than 2,000 AMU particles. So these are not really, these are molecules, okay? And what they're thinking is that they're probably aggregates of what is called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. And a classic example of a PAH is a buckyball, some of you may have heard of that in astrophysics, which is a big, giant molecule that's sort of wrapped up on itself into the shape of a ball. So that's only an example of what a polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon might be. And so they've discovered these very, very, very heavy things that if they're aggregates, it's easy how they could become negatively charged, that drop down into the lower atmosphere after being created higher up. So the picture that we've put together of this is that you have energetic charge. So now I'm on page 21, energetic charged particles impinging in the atmosphere of Titan. You have dissociation of these atmospheric methane and hydrocarbons, ionization of the same, and then agglomeration of these heavy particles, and then they drop down into the atmosphere of Titan. And so this is cool. This is a very, very interesting discovery because it tells us a little bit about how complex organic molecules might have originated and continue to populate the atmosphere and environment of Titan. So page 22, was there a question?
I was just going to interject quickly that I think that we might have a charm telethon dedicated to Titan's negative ions coming up.
Okay, fantastic. Okay.
You can hear more.
Okay, fantastic. I think that's one of the most interesting of the results, and the whole idea of the chemistry of Titan, so different from the chemistry of the Earth, I think is absolutely fascinating. So I think that would be a very interesting charm lecture. Okay, so on slide 22, one of the things we needed to understand was the upper atmosphere and ionosphere of Saturn, and what they call investigating the sources of what they call Saturn electrostatic discharges, or SEDs. And I'm not going to say much about this, even though I put a lot of the bullets down. They have noticed field-aligned currents. I've moved on to page 23. We show on page 23 is shown the aurora, which I talked about being a semi-permanent feature there, which we've seen the downward precipitating electrons going into the auroral zone, and we think we know where they're originating. And so these are important exploratory types of mapping out some of the processes that's happening in the magnetosphere that we have accomplished with the Prime mission. I moved on to page 24. Okay, we had with Jupiter, with the Galileo mission, we discovered quite a few interesting things about the icy satellites in the Jovian magnetosphere, including discovering an icy moon that has its own magnetosphere. What a surprise that was. And so we have wanted to do more exploratory work studying the icy satellites, their atmospheres, and any extended atmosphere or gas clouds that they may have, and those interactions with the magnetosphere and the ring. And lo and behold, yet another surprise, which is that Enceladus seems to be active. It is putting out a plume of water vapor into the and other molecules into the Saturn's magnetosphere. It was the magnetometer itself that first noticed this because of the mass loading of Saturn's magnetic field lines in the vicinity, distorted the magnetic flux in the region. And so, yet again, another incredible surprise with an icy moon in a magnetosphere. And there's plenty more exploration to be done of this particular moon. Almost last, we discovered that a ring has an ionosphere. So the intent was to investigate ring magnetosphere and coupling of the rings to the ionosphere, all those electromagnetic interactions, and to investigate electromagnetic processes that are responsible for ring structure. And among the things that we discovered was that there could be a ring, that there is an ionosphere associated with a ring. So that is page 27. And I'm not going to say more than that. I'm going to conclude with just talking a little bit about what remains to be done. So I talked about the reconnection being one of the most important, it's actually one of the most important processes in plasma physics around the solar system and in the interstellar medium. We see it everywhere, and we definitely want to study how it works at Saturn, and those measurements will be taken in the Equinox and Cassini solstice missions.
We just had a really big earthquake here in Pasadena.
No kidding.
I'm shaking.
Is everybody okay?
I mean, we're in Building 230, which is like, you know, a bunker. Ooh.
How long did it last?
Oh, 20 seconds?
20 seconds?
Wow. I mean, my clocks were shaking off the wall.
Oh, my God. Jane, does everything seem like it's okay?
So far, I don't see anything falling off of... Yeah, nothing fell off off the desks around here. Sorry to interrupt.
Are you a California native?
Oh, yeah, well, close enough. I used to live on the San Andreas Fault, so.
Give us your best estimate of what what the magnitude of it was. Was it 5 or a 6?
Oh. Depends on how far away it was.
Yeah, let me go on to the USGS.
Yeah, I've got it up now. Yeah, they don't have it there yet.
Oh, man.
I'll hit reload until they give an estimate.
I'm bringing up CNN right here. But just your sense. So was it like?
It's bigger than I've ever felt ever.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Huge. It was either really big and far away, or
no,
not that
it was
big
here.
Far.
We're in Southern California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was huge. We're still moving.
Where are you?
I'm near Long Beach.
Okay, so it's down there. Because we're not feeling aftershocks here.
And where are you?
In Pasadena.
Oh, you're at JPL.
Yeah.
You guys have to know this stuff.
I'm hitting reload on the USGS page now, but they don't have it yet.
Yeah, it's not coming up on the tracker I have either.
I'm hitting reload on CNN.
Yeah, I get the earthquake announcements, so.
Well, if Long Beach is feeling aftershocks, then it was down there somewhere. Oh, there it is. 5.6 Chino Hills is the preliminary.
Wow.
In a hotel with
5.6. Well, that disrupted this teleconference.
Sorry. I'll mute. I'm going to mute, you can continue, and maybe between the talks, I'll give an update.
Okay, let's do that. Okay. After that excitement, I just want to wrap this up. Let me move on to page 29, and just say that. There were, with the excitement around Enceladus, we didn't really get a chance to do up-close and personal exploration of Mimas, Dione, Tethys, and Rhea, so there's some interest in doing that. There will be continued exploration of Enceladus' plume and its interaction with the magnetosphere. There's just so much still to do with Titan, and I'm just going to leave it at that. And then... the whole inner magnetosphere with the SOI. So we would like to continue to do what they call proximal science, or the science very close to Saturn, and that'll be something that will be studied for the very end of mission. So with that, I'm going to sort of conclude. The rest of it is the sort of definitions of things. To answer Amanda's question about the inner magnetosphere, there is a picture that I left off of this. I left out a whole discussion of that, and it was in the previous charm talk that I gave about a year ago. It's the MIMI measurements of the neutrals, and it's a wedge shape, a continuous wedge shape, out to about, I think, 14 RJ, RS, something like that. And exactly how those neutrals and energetic particles interact with each other to give what's the ultimate shape, they're just now starting to understand the distribution functions and the it behaves a little bit like a comet, where the ring distribution is how it initially is distributed, and then it ends up changing the distribution function of the charge particles. But all that is still tentatively mapped out. It's not, we don't, I think, have a much better picture. We know it doesn't make a sharp angle. That's an artist rendering. But I don't think we have a really good picture yet of how that region, the different populations of charged particles, how they interact with one another.
Okay, interesting enough. Thank you. Okay, so we have, there's different magnetospheric-related backup slides that Claudia put in here, so this is great. And does anybody have any questions for Claudia right now? Because we'll move on to the Titan section, and people can ask questions about the magnetospheric stuff at the very end as well. But if anybody wants to jump in with a question now, please do so. Otherwise, we'll get into Titan with...
Hi.
Hi.
It's David Del Monte here. I'm sorry about the earthquake. It seems to be rather large to L.A. as well as Northern California.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, my daughter is in Los Angeles. Quick question. The slides are fascinating. Are they for public dissemination? Can we use some of them in our presentation?
Do you mean the artist rendering, the group of slides that are in the appendix?
Just the some of the slides in the PDF generally, and some of the photos.
Okay. Yes, I believe that all of this is for public consumption.
Okay, thanks.
The whole package.
And good luck to everybody out there.
Dr. Elizabeth Turtle, are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, let's start on Titan. And I think we're on slide 39 now for everybody who's listening in.
Yep. So I'm going to give an overview of what we've seen on Titan in the last year. Slide 40 has a list of the Titan flybys that occurred in the last year, which is the 34th through the 44th, 11 close flybys to Titan. And I've just listed their dates and also what happened basically at closest approach during each of these encounters. You can see, and I've used the abbreviations for the instruments here, but VIMS, the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, had high-resolution mapping on a number of these flybys, and the radar instrument got synthetic aperture radar strips of on several of these flybys. And as well, often at closest approach, the ion and neutral mass spectrometer takes data actually sampling the upper reaches of Titan's atmosphere. So those instruments typically are the ones that are most common, as you can see here, most commonly make observations at closest approach. But if you go down to the next slide, slide 41, you'll see an incredibly busy representation of all of the Titan flybys in the nominal mission. And this is just to illustrate just how much is going on Cassini during these encounters. You know, I've kind of listed the highlights in slide 40, But slide 41 really illustrates in much more detail what's going on. So reading across each line, each colored line with, you know, they have lots of colors on them, each of those is a single encounter, and each color represents a specific instrument. You can actually kind of, if you can make it out, it's not terribly high resolution through the PDF, through the PowerPoint into the PDF again, but each color represents a different instrument. You can kind of make out which instruments those are, and then it's just the time going through the, as you go across, it's just the time going through the flyby, and then as you move down, each line is representing a different flyby. And generally, we actually observe Titan for 12 to 24 hours before and after closest approach. And you can see kind of in this pattern that some of the instruments are more likely to observe on near closest approach or as we're further away from Titan, depending on the specific goals of that that instrument. So this this slide represents an awful lot of work on behalf of an awful lot of people and arguing or negotiating, maybe I should say, back and forth. But there's really a lot going on, and that's what's led to the results that I'm going to discuss in the upcoming slides and the papers that are really starting to stream out from the Cassini mission. I think it was mentioned right when I connected into the telecon, someone was talking about the books that people are working on. And in fact, there's a meeting this week. There was one about Titan just a couple weeks ago. So there's a lot of synthesis of all the 4 years of data we have going on. So on slide 42, I've shown a recent image, and in fact, there was another one released just yesterday of some clouds near the North Pole on Titan. Titan's season is currently moving toward northern spring. When Cassini arrived in July 04, so just 4 years ago, it was essentially the equivalent of mid-January, about the 12th of January on Earth, so northern winter. And in the last 4 years, the Saturnian system, Titan itself, has moved almost towards spring. So in the last 4 years, we've basically gone from the 12th of January to the 8th of March. So we're coming up on the vernal equinox, and as the seasons are changing on Titan, we're seeing changes in the distribution of the clouds, changes in the meteorology, as of course we do here on Earth. When Cassini arrived, we were seeing a lot of intense activity of convective cloud cells at the South Pole. And those basically disappeared at the end of 2004. There haven't been many big outbursts at the South Pole seen since then. We have been seeing clouds at higher and higher southern, or lower and lower, I should say, southern latitudes, but kind of these streaks. And now that the North Pole is kind of coming out, is being illuminated as the sun moves further north, and that area is illuminated, we're seeing these clouds up at about 60 degrees north latitude quite consistently, actually. Now, of course, we're only getting snapshots for the most part with Cassini, or we have been. If you go back to slide 40, you know, in the whole last year, we've had 11 close encounters with Titan, so that's about once a month, roughly. That's just kind of, you know, if you were trying to predict the weather on Earth, for example, and you were only getting an image every month, it might be hard unless you live in some place like Arizona or Southern California, where the weather stays the same all the time. There are ground-based, Earth-based monitoring programs, and we're now instituting something similar on Cassini, where basically any time there's a space in some of the observations, we actually are just turning the spacecraft to look at Titan and just take pictures, try to get a few pictures every week so we just can monitor the weather a bit better and watch how it's changing as we move into spring. And in fact, there was a fairly big outburst this spring between a couple of the Cassini Titan encounters that was observed by Earth-based observers. So we're hoping to catch more of those. But anyway, I wanted to illustrate that we're seeing the meteorology changing with the seasons on Titan. Something else on slide 43, something else that we're tracking is the haze on Titan. This shows a series of observations, three different observations taken at different times, clearly very different phase angles. The one on the bottom left, the sun is basically behind the spacecraft, and the one on the bottom right, the sun is basically behind Titan, as seen by the spacecraft. You can see this detached haze, kind of a ring around the upper reaches of Titan's atmosphere. And that's something that was also observed by Voyager, but one of the things that's interesting is that we're seeing it at a rather different altitude. It was at about 300, 350 kilometers when Voyager flew by. And it's currently, what the Cassini spacecraft has been observing, is at about 500 kilometers. So it's actually substantially higher. And it'll be interesting to watch, again, as the as Titan moves into spring, which is the season when Voyager 1 encounters Titan, also Voyager 2, it'll be interesting to see if this changes, if it's a seasonal effect or if something else has changed the altitude of this haze.
So is the haze layer, is it global then?
Yes.
It's global, but the altitude of it might change with seasons?
Well, that's what we're not sure of, because the altitude was due. We have the Voyager data from 1980, which was the equivalent of it was just after spring on Titan, and Cassini has been there and has been observing the haze at about 150 kilometers higher altitude, and now we're approaching the same season. So as we move into the extended mission with Cassini, we'll be able to watch, and if the spacecraft and things continue long enough, maybe we'll actually overlap the same season as the Voyager encounters. And if so, and the haze is still at a different altitude, then it's not purely seasonal.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
So it's interesting and may indicate that something more complex than simply a seasonal change is going on in the atmosphere. The 44th slide illustrates is a map of Titan that was released last October. We're continually updating these maps, and there is more territory that has been filled in more recent encounters, but this is the most recent one we've released. It takes a lot of work to process the images of Titan to remove the atmospheric effects to the extent possible. And you can see a lot of seams in this map. A lot of the maps of the other satellites look much cleaner. And part of this is because of the complicating effect of the haze and how much different processing you have to apply when you're looking at Titan under different geometric conditions, different illumination angles. And in fact, it's proven surprisingly difficult to handle adding in the high northern territory. You can see that most of our coverage in this map from last fall is below 60 degrees north latitude, and a lot of that is because of the because it's been northern winter and the illumination is only moving up that far. But it's also it's hard to process those images in a way that we can seamlessly move them into this map. And we do, in fact, now have coverage of the North Pole at near infrared wavelength. The scattering in the atmosphere helps because there's so much scattering that the surface is actually illuminated beyond the terminator. We can actually see about 10 degrees beyond the terminator. So we've imaged the North Polar region now, but it's just been hard to add into the map. So we'll be updating that as we can. But we have basically global coverage of the surface of Titan, with the exception of some of the highest northern territory. And this is a near infrared map. This is made by the Imaging Science Subsystem ISS. A lot of the mapping until now, as the sun's begun illuminating the surface, a lot of the mapping has been done by the radar instrument. And that on slide 45 shows that coverage. This is a very false color image from the radar instrument, illustrating the distribution of lakes on Titan. at Titan's North Pole. So the dark blue areas, the areas that have been colored blue here, represent areas where liquid is expected to be on the surface based on the radar evidence. And so you can see there's quite a variety of lakes, and the coverage of the North Pole is by the radar instrument is being increased. There were several flybys. The next slide, there's a URL at the bottom of this page. There's a movie associated with this release. So there's just an image here, but you can follow that link and download a movie of this fifth territory. The rightmost radar swath fills in some coverage of Kraken Mare, which is an 1,100 kilometer long lake or sea, I guess, on the surface of Titan at high northern latitudes. And this was actually discovered in early 2007. Slide 46 has a couple of images taken by the ISS, the camera on Cassini, on the left, showing this kind of squiggly dark feature that extends for 1,100 kilometers across the surface of Titan at high northern latitudes. Again, you can actually see some cloud streaks in this image as well from February 2007. Soon after that, radar also observed, or about that same time, radar also observed the very northern tip of Kraken Mare, and the image on the right kind of outlines the blue outlines the dark areas that were seen by the camera in the near infrared, and then you can see how those overlap in the radar. And so on slide 45, you can see that rightmost radar swath has now covered another piece of Kraken Mare a little further south, kind of filling that area in. I'll also mention while looking at slide 45. Pardon? Is there a question?
No, I think you were just breaking up a little bit, though.
Oh, weird. Okay.
Can you just say that last little bit again?
About
after you were talking about how you filled in that one region again.
Right. Okay. So the radar has now gotten another slice of Kraken Mare further south. While I'm on this slide, I'll point out you can see that the North Pole is kind of not covered by the radar so far, and there's actually a lake seen just below the North Pole as it's oriented in this image. And ISS just a month ago or so actually has gotten some images that show the edge of that, the other edge of that lake, kind of closing around that lake toward the North Pole. So we're filling in that territory and mapping out the northern lakes with the combination of both of those instruments. So slide 47 is another image of the North Polar Territory. And in two of the radar swaths actually overlap in such a way as to create stereo, basically a radar stereo pair. And what's shown at the bottom here is the topography derived from that stereo. And the red areas are high, and the blue and the purple areas are low, and some of those, in fact, are crossing the top of Mare Kraken. You can see there's that kind of island at the very top of Mare Kraken, and that's kind of standing out with fairly high topography, relatively high topography, standing up above that lake. So the radar instrument can also, in addition to having a mode that measures the altimetry, can actually get stereo and more high-resolution topography like this in areas where the swaths overlap. And this is one of the first high-resolution topographic maps of Titan, which is really interesting and will help interpret the geology of the surface, the drainage patterns, for example. Having the slope information helps understand how liquids are draining across the surface into the lakes, and we can get the heights of the lakes, the relative heights, to to try to understand the methane table and the methane cycle on Titan. Now, until recently, radar hadn't really been able to see high southern latitudes. This is this last year was the first time that the radar instrument actually got SAR data of high southern latitudes. Until now, it had been mapping out the North Pole, but because of the geometry of the encounters, they hadn't had any South Polar coverage yet. But in October, and then again in December, there were some radar observations during when Cassini was passing near Titan's South Pole. The one on the left from October is showing territory at about 70 degrees south latitude, and you can see that there are a couple, there are two or three features that have been identified as possible lakes at that latitude. In December, there was actually a close flyby where radar has got a swath of data that covers the South Pole itself, and you can see in this case that there are two areas they've identified as containing liquid as being lakes. If you go down to slide 49, you'll see the same image, the same radar image of Titan's South Pole on the right, and a near-infrared image from the ISS instrument on the left. And in fact, this observation on the left is one in which ISS suggested that the feature near the bottom that looks kind of like an upside-down footprint might be a lake, and that is indeed named Ontario Lacus because it's about the size of Lake Ontario. Of course, the camera has been able to, the VIMS instrument and the ISS instrument have been able to image the South Pole when we've had the favorable geometry because it's been completely illuminated. And you can see that there's actually quite a lot of variation in the surface brightness. The very bright material near the top is actually clouds in the atmosphere, but the dark and the very dark features and the gray are actually the surface. And this is quite an old observation taken just from just about a year into the mission, but it provides a very interesting comparison with the radar observation of the South Pole, because not all of those dark features appear to be lakes at this time. Now, clearly a fair amount of time has passed on Titan, and so one of the possibilities is that there are changes. Another possibility is simply that what we're seeing as dark in the ISS image is not always liquid. And that's, of course, true at the equator as well. In the near-infrared, the equatorial regions have very large expanses of dark material, and that's actually solid sand, dunes of hydrocarbon solid material, particulate material. And so it may be similar here that some of these areas are maybe not dunes, but also places where there's solid accumulations of hydrocarbons instead of liquids, and they're not showing up as liquids in the radar data. But it's a very intriguing comparison and something that we're really looking forward to getting more data of in the extended mission, and hopefully even further on to try to make this comparison and understand better what we're seeing with the different instruments, and to see if we're seeing evidence for changes on the surface, which is another possibility, especially given that we've seen large cloud systems there early on, and there might have been rain, and since those have dried up, perhaps it's not raining as much. Another thing, another comparison between some of the early observations of the South Pole and the recent radar observation is shown on the 50th slide. This shows, in fact, an image that was taken during.
Hey, Vivi?
Yes.
Yeah. Amanda had a question.
Oh. Okay.
Sorry, we're muted on accident, and I was. Can we go back to 49?
Sure.
I just wanted to make sure I understand. So, did you say that the red plus indicates the South Pole?
I did not say that, but you have correctly interpreted that. I should have said that. The red plus is about where the South Pole is. Yes. And
okay.
These are very different scales. So the very dark feature that you see, the blue feature that you see in the in the radar observation, is actually the dark feature that's at about 7 o'clock below the red plot. It's not all the way down at Ontario Lacus.
Is Ontario Lacus the kidney bean-shaped one in the image?
Yep, at the bottom of the image, yep. And that's about, just for scale, that's about 237 kilometers along, 237 kilometers long, if I remember correctly.
And so is that the one that you're saying doesn't show up in the radar?
Radar hasn't observed it yet. It's not in the radar.
Out of the cloth, kind of here.
Right, it's not in the radar cloth. I know they get that in the extended mission, but I'd be guessing at which flyby it is. But I know they do get to observe it during the extended mission. At least once, if not twice.
And then so
we will get radar data of that. And VIMS actually had a really high resolution view of Ontario Lacus also last December. And they're analyzing the spectra of that. And I think there's a paper that's quite soon to come out in maybe Nature by Bob Brown about it.
Oh, okay. But then the lake that you can see, you know, partially in the radar image.
Yep.
Where does that correspond to in the ISS image?
Right. If you look in the ISS image where the South Pole is, at about 7 o'clock beneath it, you see it's kind of just gray. I highlighted this. I'm sorry. It's kind of gray right beneath the plus sign. And then
okay.
It gets dark again. The very dark feature in the radar is that kind of diamond-shaped, very dark feature in the ISS. It's just the edge of that.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And then can I ask another question while I have you? Is that back on 47 about the topography?
Yep.
So I think this is really neat because I haven't seen any radar topography before. But the so in the two swaths down at the bottom, they're both radar. And so the way I'm interpreting this is that the kind of medium dark area over towards the left is actually a deeper region than the super dark area that's by the little cutout and more in the middle.
Yeah, I don't know what the uncertainty is on this. There aren't error bars on their legend.
Because it
looks like it's about the same. Or do you mean way at the left?
I don't mean way at the left. I mean sort of that sort of, let's see. So it's kind of just to the left of center of the whole entire swath.
Yep. Yeah, it does look
purple
more
in the topography, and it's just kind of grayish in the regular radar image.
Yep.
And then, but then the area to the right of that that's really dark in the radar image is more blue. And so I always kind of picture in my mind that the really dark regions in the radar images are deeper, maybe, but that's probably the wrong way to think about it.
Right. The really dark regions in the radar images are where no signal is coming back to the spacecraft from the radar, So... it basically means that all of the signal sent out from the radar is reflected away. So that's actually more an effect of the surface properties than the topography.
Right. Okay.
Now, obviously, you'd expect the lowest areas to be the ones that have liquids, and that's something that that the radar team is working on right now. And again, I think there's a paper being written about it right now. Is what the methane table, the equivalent on Titan of the water table on Earth, what it is, and whether the lake levels are actually the same, the methane levels are the same in all of these lakes, or whether they differ. Because if they differ, then that suggests no connectivity or less connectivity between the lakes within the subsurface of Titan.
Oh, right.
And so that's important for understanding what the transport of methane within and under the surface of Titan.
Okay.
So that's a really good point. Not all the lakes may be at the same level, and that's something they're analyzing.
Okay, that's neat. Thanks.
Sure. Let's see. So on slide 50. We have another comparison of the radar here, actually, on the far right. I'll interrupt myself. On the far right, you can actually see that the radar swath where that little dark area matches up with the diamond-shaped dark area we saw in the near-infrared. So this the imaging observation that's underlined here, that's on the left, the middle, and underlined on the right, was taken just after Cassini went into orbit around Saturn. This was just after Saturn orbit insertion on the T0 flyby, which is actually a very distant flyby, but the camera actually can get pretty decent resolution of the surface of features of objects, even at 100,000. This is actually at 300,000 kilometers range. And you can see at the top, there's this dark feature, which is named Mesurania. At the bottom of this image, there's actually a lot of really bright stuff again, which is one of those large cloud outbursts. And you're seeing some of the dark features and the gray of the surface beneath it. But leading into Mesurania at the top, you can kind of see this dark channel feature that had been pointed out by ISS, and that's kind of outlined in red in the center image. And on the right, you can see that the radar image actually covers this area, and you can see the detail that the radar instrument can reveal, because it gets much higher resolution than ISS could get on this distant encounter. On the 51st slide, you see that I put in that radar swap again just blew it up a little bit, so you can actually see much more of the detail, and you can see how channeled the surface is. There definitely has been liquid flow on the surface of Titan, which is another piece of evidence that really supports the interpretation of a lot of these dark features on the surface as liquid as lakes, because clearly water has been flowing on the surface, carving the surface into river channels and ponding in areas. So we're looking forward to more observations of the high southern territory with the radar instrument as the extended mission progresses. The 52nd slide shows a couple examples of tectonics. One thing that is really actually lacking from Titan is large tectonic structures or global tectonic patterns. If you look at many satellites, you know, Dione, Rhea, Tethys, and Enceladus, you can see evidence of the energetic processes in the deformation of the surface. You can see that the geologic processes have been modifying the surface of the planet, and we would certainly expect that to occur on Titan as well. But there's not a lot of evidence for it, and some of that is because Titan, like Earth, it undergoes erosion from liquids flowing on the surface, from material blowing across the surface, just like we have here on Earth. And so that erodes tectonic features, but I find it particularly intriguing how little we've seen in the way of tectonics. There are a few features revealed here that are quite linear. Often you see mountain chains aligned on Earth or other planets, and that's an indication of tectonic activity. And so here on the right is actually a much older image, which is one of the ones where some mountain chains had been observed. And on the left is a very recent image just from this past May, showing some other mountain chains, just kind of three parallel ones running across the center of that image. The bright rough terrain the rough terrain that is revealed by brighter radar albedos. So these are about, you can see that those chains, based on the scale bar, each of the range is about 50 kilometers across, and the topography on Titan isn't actually terribly high. These are referred to as mountains often, but they're typically a kilometer or so high, which is still pretty rugged and not an easy place to land.
And in that image on the left, is that circular feature a lake?
I do not believe so. I don't remember. This is not one of the high latitude passes, and
impact crater.
It is suspiciously circular. In order for it to be identified as a lake, it has to have really low signal, and you can actually see it's dark, but it's still gray. It's not you know, a complete absence of signal, which is really almost absence of signal, which is what you'd expect from a lake. The fact that it is circular might suggest that it has an impact origin. It certainly doesn't look terribly fresh. because the other features around it, you don't see an ejecta blanket or something like that, which you would expect if it were a fresh impact crater. But again, Titan, like Earth, has a lot of erosion going on, and the you know, if you compare the moon, our moon, to the surface of the Earth basically has, you know, very, very few impact craters, only about 150 compared to the moon, which is covered with them, and that's because of the erosion, and Titan is very similar. So an image like this, it's very hard to tell what that feature is, which is leads to lots of speculation, but it has potential. That actually leads very well into the next slide, slide 53, which shows a couple of impact craters observed on Titan. As I mentioned, Titan doesn't have a lot of impact craters. I think maybe there are five officially. There really are only a handful of impact craters that we can fairly confidently identify as impact craters on Titan, which is very surprising. And just attests to the amount of modification of the surface of Titan. The one on the right, again, is one of the earliest. In fact, this is the second impact crater identified on Titan. It's an 80-kilometer diameter crater named Synlap. The one on the left, it was also observed just in a radar flyby last May, and that's about 112 kilometers across. And you can see here, so these are rather bigger than the circular feature that was revealed in the previous image, but you can also see a lot more of the structure. You can see that these are depressions with rugged rims. Synlap on the right, there's this bright halo around it, which may be part of the ejecta that's been eroded or is being buried by the dunes that you can see kind of wrapping around Synlap. There are hints of an ejecta blanket around the crater on the left, but it too is somewhat degraded. It's not a pristine crater the way we see on the surfaces of most of the other icy satellites in the Saturnian system. On the 54th slide, there are a couple of images, a distant image taken last fall of the region above Adiri. Adiri is that bright feature in the middle of all the dark features that are running along the equator. The North Pole is just slightly to the left of up in that left-hand image. Just for reference, the Huygens landing site is actually at the kind of end of that finger that points out toward the eastern end of Adiri. And we got one of our best views of this region with the ISS camera last fall, and then again this May we got a very high-resolution view, and that's shown on the right. And right above Adiri, you can see this is a bright feature with a dark center and then a kind of grayish halo, and that looks an awful lot in the near infrared the way Synlap, and I didn't put that comparison in, but it looks a lot in the infrared the way Synlap, which is the crater on slide 53 on the right hand side, the way it looks in the infrared. And so this is a feature that we think is likely to also be an impact crater. But we don't have the topographic information, so we're going off the albedo information. But because it looks so much like Synlap, we think this feature may also be a crater. It's about 90 kilometers in diameter.
Is that the same as the Synlap one?
It's about the same. Synlap's about 80. And Synlap, too, is right down in one of these dark dune-filled regions. So this is in a very similar territory on the other side of the planet. But like I said, they're really, and so in the last year, we may have identified two more craters on the surface of Titan. They're not a lot. One of the other really exciting discoveries of in the last year is illustrated graphically on page 55, and that is that Titan has likely has an interior ocean. This is a discovery based on all of the years of observations that came before. And basically the way it was discovered is that the radar team, as they were aligning their maps, the different radar SAR strips, which you can see kind of intersect because they're these noodles that run across the surface. And so there are these little strips covering the surface. And and they line them up to map out the surface. And they were finding that they weren't quite in the right places. The later ones, compared to the earlier ones, were off in places by up to 30 kilometers or so. And the model they were using to predict what part of the surface they were observing in any given time was based on the rotation inferred for Titan and accounting for the gravitational influences of Saturn and the large satellites and all of the large gravitational influences, but couldn't account for this shift of tens of kilometers of the regions on the surface relative to where we thought they were. And the way to explain that is that there's actually enough momentum in Titan's atmosphere that it is affecting the surface, the rotation or the motion of the surface relative to the interior of Titan. But the only way for something like the atmosphere to actually be able to affect the rotation of the surface is if the surface itself is decoupled from the interior, from the core, by a liquid layer. And so that indicates that there is an ocean deep within Titan. It's not we can say that it's not likely to be too shallow based on the morphology of some of the surface features, especially the impact craters. They're particularly useful for estimating the thickness of icy lithosphere, of any lithosphere, because impact craters actually can, the very large ones like Minerva on Titan, which is a few hundred kilometers across, affect the deep subsurface as well and are affected by the deep subsurface. And so if there were a very thin surface layer on Titan above an ocean, then it would be easy for such a large impact to have punched through. So the fact that that didn't punch through, that it impacted into a solid surface, implies that the lithosphere, the crust on Titan, has to be, 100 kilometers, on the order of hundreds of kilometers thick. But nonetheless, the fact that the surface is shifting indicates that it is a solid icy surface over a liquid layer above the interior core. So that's a really exciting discovery, and it will actually be followed up on by a gravity pass that T-45, so the first Titan encounter of the extended mission, is coming up at the end of this month. I guess that's now. Wow. I don't know how it's the end of July already. So that's just coming up the end of this week, and it's a pass that the radio science instrument is actually the prime instrument, as we call it, at closest approach, and that's to detect to get detailed information about the gravity, the interior of Titan, based on its the gravitational attraction that Cassini feels as it flies close to Titan in this encounter. So that will really add to our interpretation of the interior of Titan as well. And the
can I ask a question about the ocean? Is the evidence for the ocean, is it just the radar team? And secondly, how similar is that evidence to the evidence that came up with Jupiter's moon Europa?
I think the strongest evidence for an ocean in the interior of Titan is this shift in the surface, that over 4 years there's actually a 30-kilometer shift in the locations of, in the ice shell has rotated so differently from what one would predict for a solid body that features on the surface are 30 kilometers different from where you would expect them. That's I guess, the most solid evidence, if you will, of a liquid layer. The radio science team and the navigation team are also studying the interior of Titan based on the gravity felt by Cassini during encounters with Titan. And, of course, there have been a lot of encounters with Titan, and a few of them so far, and the one coming up this week, have been devoted to radio science. But they're looking at the bigger structure and can't distinguish they don't have they can't resolve it, if you will.
The moment of
it.
Isn't
they can't resolve it with moment of inertia data.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
There are also, though, a lot of models that suggest that Titan should have a liquid layer. Models of the thermal evolution of Titan would suggest a liquid layer as well, a deep liquid layer. And in fact, that's also predicted, and magnetometer data have demonstrated that at Ganymede around Europa and also Callisto.
But they don't have the magnetometer data yet for Titan.
Right, and it's much harder to do that for Titan because you can't get very close to Titan.
And
the Galilean satellite, The Galilean satellites, you can get right down close to the surface with a spacecraft.
Right.
But for Titan, we can't get really within 950 kilometers is the closest we've been, and so the magnetometer is kind of hampered by the fact that we're so far away from Titan. I think on the 70th flyby, the last flyby of the extended mission, the plan is to get Cassini as close to Titan as possible, and that's at about 900 kilometers, if I recall correctly.
Right.
So that will help with that may help, but it's going to be harder for the magnetometer team. It's also harder for the gravity team. That's one of the reasons that we can't get as good gravity for Titan, simply because we just can't get that close. The evidence for an ocean in Europa, there are multiple lines of evidence. One is simply based on the surface morphology. A lot of the features on the surface are consistent with a thin ice shell. Again, the impact craters are particularly diagnostic. And two of the largest impact craters on Europa have lots of graben, surrounded by concentric graben. The crater itself is surrounded. In fact, there isn't a crater so much as a disrupted area with lots of concentric graben. And that would be consistent with impact into an ice layer that's only 25-30 kilometers thick. And so the evidence that we don't have ice that thin on Titan is that we don't see that morphology that we do on Europa. There's also magnetometer evidence for Europa as well.
Right.
I don't think we have evidence of non-synchronous rotation for Europa the way we do for Titan, though.
It's in the stress field. It took many, many, many measurements to sort of get the stresses, and then the various crack patterns are consistent with the stresses that you would get with a non-synchronous rotation.
Yes, the cycloidal fractures
on Europa.
The cycloidal fractures on Europa, it's very hard to explain those except with a thin ice layer that fractures easily. And you're right, that does show non-synchronous rotation over a much longer time scale, yes.
Right.
Yes. Right. I don't think we have the direct evidence within different missions of the time scale changing, but over the geologic history of Europa, there is evidence for the non-synchronous rotation. Thank you. And the last slide was simply looking ahead to the next year, where we have 13 more flybys, including T-45, which is the 31st. So there's a lot to come, and that's just the first year of the extended mission. So I will leave it there and take questions if there are more questions.
Great, thank you. Anybody have questions? I have a couple.
Is anybody still there from Los Angeles?
Yeah. Yeah. You'll see Los Angeles people are doing okay.
I hope so.
Yeah, they downgraded it to a 5.4, and there's no reports of damage.
Oh, interesting.
It's quieted down here.
Okay, that's good. It says 5.8 on the data I have.
It felt,
it
just reloaded it. It went 5.4. it felt big.
Yeah.
I bet. Hey, a couple quick Titan questions I had, and I hope other people ask questions if they have them too. But Jimmy, you said T-45 is the first. Is that that's the first in the extended mission, right? So that's the one that's at the end of the week.
Yep, that's the 31st.
Okay.
The nominal mission went through T-44.
And then back on the next to the last slide, with the ocean. What What are we looking at there? I just want to make sure I understand.
Right. I think so. The brown, I think, is the atmosphere kind of overlying the surface. You can kind of see the surface at the edges. The kind of mucky brown that's on the outside of the planet. And then there is there are a few different layers. The blue layer.
The light blue layer underneath the brown surface, and then a dark blue layer, which I presume is the ocean.
Yeah, so the dark blue layer is the ocean. I think the light blue layer is the subsurface layer, so the one that's probably on the order of a few hundred kilometers thick. And then the white layer is another solid ice layer before you get down to the rocky, potentially rocky metallic mixture in the core or in the deep interior. So it's an intriguing distinction on Titan and probably Ganymede as well, compared to another interesting comparison to Europa. On Europa, the water layer is probably in contact with the silicate material in the interior of Europa, whereas on Ganymede and on Titan, the water layer actually is above, the liquid water layer is above an ice, a water ice layer before you get down to the silicate and metallic material in the deep interior.
Oh, okay, interesting.
So that certainly will affect the chemical evolution of the liquid layer, the liquid water.
Right.
Not being in contact with the silicate.
And is it thought that there's a metallic only core, or is it that the core it's differentiated such that the core and silicate it's a silicate metallic core mix?
That's the kind of question that the moment of inertia data, the gravity experiment, can try to help to answer if they get essentially high enough resolution. The extent to which the mass in the interior of Titan is concentrated in the core or distributed without, is distributed more generally in the interior. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure that we have the data to answer that yet.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Thank you. Best case scenario and funding issues aside, what's the possible lifespan of Cassini?
Well, one of the great things about the Saturnian system, as compared to the experience we had with Galileo and the Jovian system, is that the radiation is not the radiation environment in the Jovian system. So that's not degrading things as quickly as happened for poor Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
The current plan is for a 2-year extended mission, which will take us through the equinox, the northern vernal equinox. If resources hold out, if the spacecraft is healthy and funding holds out, it's not just the resources on the spacecraft. One of the things that's being looked at right now is whether it would be possible to keep Cassini going in another extended mission, ideally through the solstice, which is in 2017, the northern summer solstice, which would just give us a spectacular amount of data of the seasonal changes in the rings and in Saturn itself and, of course, on Titan. And a great long baseline for understanding the activity on Enceladus as well. But, of course, that depends on those resources holding out and the spacecraft holding up. But that kind of there's the potential for that. And we're certainly hoping that would be able to happen.
Follow-up question. The New Horizons spacecraft flew by Jupiter. Will that trajectory pass it through the Saturnian system?
I do not believe so.
Okay. Thanks. Well, thank you so much, huh?
Again, you're very welcome.
Amazing. Just amazing.
It's been an exciting year.
Yeah, when you think you're looking at things a billion miles away. Just amazing. Thanks.
A question.
questions out there? Okay, well, with that then, I think that I will give one final thank you to Dr. Turtle and Dr. Alexander. Thanks so much for putting together the presentations and taking the time to tell us all about your work. We really appreciate it. And thank you all for calling in.
Amanda, stay on for just 1 second. I need to ask you a question.
Okay. And I want to remind everybody that the charm presentation that we have in a month, which will be the last Tuesday of August, what we'll cover will be the final segment in the fourth anniversary segment, or whole set of telecons. And what we'll be covering there is results from the rings discipline, and we'll also cover what is coming in the extended mission. Stay tuned for that, and with that, we'll just thank everybody once again. Thanks for calling in, everybody.
Thank you very much from California.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Amanda?
Yeah.
I tried to call in and get the metrics, or tried to, you know, talk to the operator, and she needed to only give them to you.
I was going to star zero and go over and do it now.
Yeah. She said just for you to do star zero, and then it's a new regulation. So.
Okay. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye, Anita.
Bye.
Anita, are you still there? Ah, son of a gun.